77 WABC. The following program does not necessarily reflect the views of WABC Radio.
The following program is brought to you by NYU Winthrop Hospital. It's the weekend. Be good to yourself. It's Katz's Corner with Dr. Aaron Katz, where you get simple, straightforward answers to your questions about health, from diet and supplements to lifestyle changes. To reach Dr. Katz, call 800-848-WABC. Now, live on 77 WABC, it's the chairman of urology at NYU Winthrop Hospital in New York. Here is Dr. Aaron Katz.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Katz's Corner here on WABC Radio in New York. I'm your host, Dr. Aaron Katz, and we are live at 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. So glad that you could join me this morning. We have a wonderful show for you today. I've asked one of the most outstanding surgeons at NYU, since we are NYU Winthrop now, and we have a wonderful relationship, and we've started programs of transplant surgery where patients can be evaluated here on Long Island at NYU Winthrop in the Mineola campus. And if they are in need of a transplant, whether it be a heart transplant, lung, liver, pancreas, they can have their surgery now at NYU Langone in Manhattan. And the beauty is that after the surgery, you can then be followed here out on Long Island. And we are connected to NYU in many different ways. And one of the ways we are also connected is through the electronic medical record. So all of the information is right there at our fingertips as physicians and providers, as well as for you patients. And this morning, I've asked Dr. Nabil Dagher to join me this morning. He is an associate professor of surgery in the Department of Surgery and is the director of the Abdominal Transplant Surgery Center at NYU, and also runs the Abdominal Transplant Fellowship Program, and is really world-renowned. He trained in different fellowships at Johns Hopkins and has been at NYU for a number of years, and is going to talk with us this morning about things that are available for people in terms of transplantation. And we'll focus on liver and perhaps we'll get into pancreas and get into all of that this morning. If you have a question and you'd like to talk with us about this very important topic, the number is 1-800-848-9222. Good morning, Dr. Dagher. Thank you so much for getting up on an early Sunday morning. How are you today?
Good morning. Thank you for having me, and thanks for your kind comments. I'm doing great. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And I wanted to start out by asking you, and I know that you specialize in abdominal transplantation, which includes, I guess at NYU, you're doing both liver and pancreas?
So it would be liver, kidney, and pancreas. Actually, we have a pretty robust kidney transplant program here at NYU as well. So it would be so the abdominal organs that we transplant here are liver, kidney, pancreas.
Right. And in terms of the liver transplantation, or let's just start talking about liver disease itself, how, you know, when you're getting a physical examination yearly, and a lot of people, you know, starting the first of the year, they want to, you know, in January, let's get all of our blood tests. Are there blood tests that are included in a routine physical exam that would evaluate the liver?
Well, for sure. In a routine physical, what they usually do, especially in adults, is check what are called LFTs, or liver function tests, where they check in your blood the enzymes that the liver releases. And occasionally, not always, but occasionally, if you do have some ongoing problem with your liver, those enzymes will be elevated. The other thing that the doctor does, obviously, when they do a thorough exam, is they palpate or feel your abdomen to make sure that your liver is not enlarged or hardened or abnormal in some way.
Right, and if it was abnormal or hardened on a physical exam, and thankfully we still have physicians that do physical exams, right? I mean, because we're in this age.
Yeah, we still do. It's more
right?
rare, but yeah. We still have
it's rare. Wear a stethoscope, actually feel people. You know, we do a lot of virtual medical consultation where you can't do that, obviously, but that should be part of a regular examination, right? To feel someone's abdomen, and the liver should not be palpable. You shouldn't be able to feel a normal liver.
Exactly. Most of the solid organs are actually protected by the rib cage. So they're under and above the ribs, the liver, the spleen, the kidneys in the back. So if you're able to palpate a liver or a spleen, that means that organ is probably enlarged, and that needs to be looked at probably with an ultrasound or some other imaging study.
So that would be the next test. So if you get a call from your doctor that you have an abnormal liver test on, just a routine blood test, then the next thing would be an ultrasound.
Correct. And the other thing I'll say is, we have obviously an epidemic of hepatitis C, and that's been ongoing for a long time. So if you're someone who potentially would be at risk for hepatitis C, or if you're a baby boomer, then you should get checked for hepatitis C, because hepatitis C is one of those viruses where it can infect you and affect your liver for decades without you knowing. And just a simple test will be able to tell the doctor if you do have hepatitis C. And the great miracle of this decade has been essentially the cure for hepatitis C by these new medicines that we now have, where the cure rates are 98%, 99%. So I think anybody who potentially could have been at risk for hepatitis C should be checked for it and treated.
And I wasn't aware of the epidemic. Who would be those patients that would be at most risk for hepatitis C?
Obviously we are going through a very sad, serious time in the country with the opioid epidemic, where we have a lot of people addicted to opioids and to IV drugs. And certainly that puts them at higher risks. And we're seeing a pattern of increased hepatitis C for the first time in many years because of that. So anyone who, for sure the baby boomers, because hepatitis C up until the, mid to late 80s was kind of an unknown. We didn't know how to test for it. We didn't really know what it was. And we didn't really have very good testing for it. So a lot of those people were missed back then. So, I think for sure anybody over 40 should be getting tested at least one time for hepatitis C.
And that would not be in a routine blood test. That's something that you'd have to ask the doctor specifically to have.
Exactly. And if you're watching TV, there are now commercials all about this to tell people to, inform the public that, ask your doctor about this, get checked one time at least, just to make sure you don't have it, because the treatments are so good, it's a shame to let it go and not have it be found.
Are you still seeing patients now that have had hepatitis C that you maybe weren't treated early enough, that it's caused so much damage in their liver that they need a liver transplant?
Absolutely. It still remains one of the major indications for liver transplant, believe it or not. So, we see people that were infected in the 80s and 90s that are now coming back with cirrhosis, with essentially end-stage liver disease, who need a transplant. And I suspect we're going to be seeing that, moving forward.
And Dr. Dagher, in terms of the other conditions that you're seeing that lead to liver disease beyond the cirrhosis from hepatitis C, I guess there's alcoholic cirrhosis, right? That's probably still prevalent. What are some of the other conditions that you're seeing?
So you've got hepatitis C, you've got alcohol. Those are big indications. Mm-hmm. You have hepatitis B, which, depending on where you live in the country, is also a major indication for liver transplant. The other thing is that what we're seeing now over the last two decades is fatty liver disease. So we have an obesity epidemic in the country, not to use that word too often, but that's true. And what happens when the liver gets infiltrated with fat over a long time is that it gets injured, just like, in similar ways to the viruses and to other things that cause scarring and cirrhosis. And it's leading to increased rates of cirrhosis. So fatty liver disease is now an increasing indication for liver transplant. The other thing is that when you have cirrhosis, you're at much higher risk for liver cancer. So, you know, when the other thing to know when you get diagnosed with liver disease is that you need to be checked with ultrasound or a CT scan or an MRI every 6 months or a year to make sure that you don't develop liver cancer. And that's also an increasing indication for liver transplant to cure liver cancer.
Wow, I didn't know that. I kind of remember, maybe I'm wrong, but Mickey Mantle, did he have a liver transplant?
I don't know about Mickey Mantle. I'm not sure if he had a liver transplant, but right. But certainly many famous people have, and also for the indication of liver cancer.
Yeah.
The other thing that we also often, you know, don't think about too much is that children also get develop liver disease for many different reasons because they're born with, you know, genetic issues or metabolic issues that that affect the liver specifically. They're otherwise completely healthy, but they develop liver disease very quickly and require transplant also. So it's not just in adults. Children also, you know, are at risk for needing transplant.
And if a child needs a transplant, whether is that successful?
It is.
Are the rates pretty successful for adult and for children?
The rates, we have come a very long way for two main reasons. One is that technically we've gotten a lot better. We've refined the surgery for liver transplant, and we've figured out its pitfalls and what the risks are and how to mitigate them. And also, you know, when you get a liver transplant, you just don't get the transplant and then go home and you don't need to take any medicine because this isn't your liver. And your body knows that, and you have to take what's called immunosuppression or medicines to prevent rejection of that organ, whether it's liver, kidney, pancreas, or any organ. And so those medicines have gotten very good. So the success rates are actually fantastic for liver transplant, both in children and in adults. You know, certainly much better than they were 20, 30 years ago.
Now, and good morning, everyone. If you're just tuning in at Cancer's Corner, we are talking with Dr. Nabil Dagher, who is Associate Professor in the Department of Surgery at NYU and Chief of the Abdominal Transplant Surgery Center and Director of the Abdominal Transplant Fellowship Program. We're talking about abdominal transplantation, and this morning we're focusing on liver. And I was wondering, in terms of someone, if they need a liver transplant, does it have to be from someone that you are related to? Can you get a transplant from someone that, let's say, is unrelated or a cadaver? And what are the best transplants? I guess the best is always someone that you know or genetically related to, right? But
great question. You know, one would think that, but the reality is that actually the majority of liver transplants that happen in this country happen with a deceased donation, with people who have passed away and they are now brain dead. And they either have indicated that they want to be donors or their family would like to donate their organs. So that's getting a whole liver from someone who's passed away. And about 6,000 to 7,000 liver transplants happen every year from deceased donors. The problem is we don't have enough deceased donors in this country, especially in the state of New York. And so we have to look to other ways to transplant patients because the deceased donor livers go to the sickest patients because we're trying to save as many lives as possible. The stark reality is that a lot of people are listed for transplant that just don't have the opportunity to get a deceased donor because they're not sick enough, but they are still very sick. And that's where living donation comes in, where someone can donate a portion of their liver to a recipient who needs a liver transplant. And they could be related. They could be a son donating to his mother. They could be a husband donating to a wife. Certainly that's, you know, not related genetically, but, you know, within the family, siblings donating to each other. But the reality is also people who don't know each other can also donate to each other through living donation and have fantastic outcomes.
And how difficult is it for the donor, a live donor, let's say, whether related or unrelated, to go through this? Is it done robotically and laparoscopically, or does that require an open incision?
Right. Increasingly, even though the laparoscopic and robotic procedures are still kind of in their infancy,
I see.
It's starting to happen. But in general, the majority of donor operations still happen with open surgery.
I see.
And it is a major surgery. There's no question. But donors do very well. And we've actually looked at this. We studied this while I was at Hopkins because it is a very important question. And we looked at basically everybody who'd ever donated a liver in this country, about 5,000 patients since the mid-90s. And we looked and we asked the question, how do these patients do compared to either kidney donors, people who've donated their kidney, or just normal people in the population? And actually, liver donors do just as well and live just as long. The risks are early after surgery, just like any other operation.
Sure, sure.
And then once you get through that operation, donors do very well.
And how do you know how much liver to take? I mean, it seems, you know, the kidney, I understand, you have a kidney transplant, you take the whole kidney and the artery and the vein and you transplant it into someone else, but are you just taking just a piece of the liver and then hooking it up to the other patient, to the recipient's liver?
Well, yeah, kind of like that.
Exactly. I see.
You're absolutely right. But it is more of an art in that how much liver someone needs depends on their size, their weight, and how sick they are. So if, say, a parent is donating to a small child, they only have to donate a small piece of liver to that person, to that child. If an adult is donating to an adult, they need a much bigger piece because that person's body is bigger, they're heavier, they're going to put more stress on that liver, and so for their metabolic needs, they need a bigger piece of liver. And so it really depends on the patient, the recipient's weight, how much liver they need at the time of transplant.
And when you give a liver transplant to a child, let's say, does the liver then grow over time?
Yes.
Does it become like a regular adult liver?
It grows to the size of an adult liver as the child grows.
That's fascinating.
It's a remarkable thing that the liver actually grows back. It regenerates. And so when donors donate, that's why donors can donate, because you can take out 60-70% of someone's liver, and that remaining portion of liver, obviously, if it's healthy, will completely regenerate within 6 weeks. And so that's why living donation is possible, really, is that the liver is essentially the only solid organ that can do that.
Right. I mean, what other organ can grow over time?
Really, I mean, the skin. But that's not a solid organ. We transplant the skin, obviously, with skin grafts. But in terms of a major solid organ, it's really the only one that can regenerate the way the liver does.
That's really phenomenal. I mean, that's fascinating. And Dr. Daggett, give us an idea. I mean, how many transplants is that at NYU are you doing a year? I mean, you're doing every week? Is it?
Yeah. We've grown a lot over the past 2-3 years, where now essentially, we're doing livers every week. We also do a lot of kidney transplants. We do between 150 and 200 kidney transplants a year. We just started a pancreas program recently, which I'm very excited about. We also do hearts and lungs, and we do bone marrow transplants. So the Transplant Institute at NYU has really undergone a remarkable transformation over the past couple of years, where now we essentially can offer, transplant care across, the spectrum of organs and diseases. So it's very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, that is exciting. And one of the things that you touched on just briefly is the fact that we don't have, from what I gather, enough live, people that want to do this for transplant, as well as cadavers and people, I guess, need to sign up. There's a real need for it in New York.
You're absolutely right. It's in New York, especially, but certainly across the country. And I think the biggest issue is that the low donation rates in the population for consent to donate your organs after you pass away. I think that's where we really have where we really can move things along and educate the public that this is really something that's needed, and it can affect anybody. This can, I think nobody's really immune to end organ disease, no matter what the organ is. And at some point, your loved one may need a transplant. And so I think we really have to push The fact that organ donation is very important and really binds us all together. Living donors, are an important part of that, especially for kidney transplant and increasingly so for liver. And believe it or not, recently also for lung. There are some programs that are starting living donor for lung because we just don't have enough organs.
And what do you do? You give part of your lung to someone? Not the whole lung.
You don't give the whole lung. You need your lungs. But
you need your lungs.
Exactly. You give yeah. part of a lung. Yeah. They haven't figured it out for heart yet. But for lung.
And what about pancreas? Can you give part of your pancreas to someone?
Believe it or not, it's been done, but that's not really a standard practice. So you usually get a pancreas from a deceased donor. Yeah, you get a whole pancreas.
And that would be mainly for what, for diabetic patients?
It would be for diabetic patients, usually in general type 1 diabetics. There are different types of diabetes, as people know, and usually it's for those folks that don't make any insulin at all. That being said, also increasingly we're seeing a type of type 2 diabetic that does also do well with pancreas transplant. But yes, it's done for diabetes mainly, and to get people off insulin.
So if you're listening out there at NYU right now, what is available is heart, lung, kidney, liver, and pancreas.
You got it.
Yeah, and you're having enormous success with all of these, and a lot of it is due to your innovations and your surgical techniques and approaches in getting patients in and out of the hospital very quickly. And on the medical side, from what I'm hearing, the ability of patients to not only require these medications long-term to suppress the immune system, but the advances in the medications have led to reduced adverse events, less side effects over time.
Yeah, all those things are correct. You know, I think what makes a good transplant program is not one specific thing. It's a whole team. And it's really the epitome of teamwork, transplantation. It's not like you take out someone's gallbladder and then off they go and, you know, that's it. It really is a team effort, and you need everybody for it, for a successful outcome. And that's, I think, really what we pride ourselves on here is fantastic patient care and kind of across the whole spectrum. The other thing that we try to do is not just do surgery and take care of patients, but also learn from what we've done. And, transplantation is still one of those fields that's maturing and growing, and there's still a lot of room for innovation. And I think this is a great place for that, and we're certainly pursuing that as much as we can.
Well, being in medicine for 30-some-odd years myself, I've always had the highest respect for transplant surgeons because you're on call 24/7, it seems. I mean, you're doing transplants in the middle of the night. I mean, because you talk about saving lives. I mean, these are people that are clearly not going to survive without the transplant, or you're going to be on, like for kidney, you're going to be on dialysis. And of course, we know the mortality rate for those patients are quite high. And it's wonderful that we have the relationship with you at NYU Winthrop, and we have patients that can be evaluated and seen here on Long Island and then have their surgical procedures with outstanding surgeons and teams like yourself. Dr. Dagher, we have a few people on the line. I'd like to just in the last few moments ask them if they have questions about this particular topic. Ron from Belmore is calling. Good morning, sir.
Yeah, good morning, doctor. Listen, can you transplant a bladder?
You can transplant a bladder. Really? You can transplant a bladder. That's been done. Done at specialized centers. We don't do that here, but it's a thing. Yeah. And in fact, actually what's happening, exciting things are happening with tissue regeneration and with growing certain organs. That's one of them. But yeah, that's been done. It would be a very rare and still experimental thing at this point.
Ah, thank you, doctor.
You
wow.
got it.
Yeah, that would really be incredible, wouldn't it? I mean, because now what we're left with is, you know, to recreate a new bladder with a piece of intestine. And,
right.
And not that you need the rejection medication, but there's certainly a lot of complications that patients, you know, have following that type of a surgical procedure. Well, I just want to thank you, Dr. Dagher, for coming on the line. So in terms of just summing it up, you need to have your liver evaluated And that's easy to do with an examination and a blood test, correct?
Correct.
And I gather that many people that have liver disease, I mean, do they have any symptoms or signs of it besides just feeling the liver? I mean, are you feeling okay otherwise?
That's a great question. And, you know, I was going to add to that exactly when you had mentioned, you know, the testing. And it, you know, oftentimes it kind of creeps up on you. And it happens, especially the, you know, things like hepatitis C and other, you know, diseases like autoimmune disease and things like that, where it does creep up on you, you don't really feel it as much as, say, getting a cold or, you know, something like that, a kind of a bad illness. But there are signs, you know, if you start noticing that you're increasingly tired or fatigued, that your sleep is kind of off, that you're maybe looking a little yellow occasionally, you know, you're people are telling you, hey, why are your eyes yellow? Or you start feeling that your belly is, you know, more bloated than usual. If you bleed, you know, more easily, you know, if you cut yourself or brush your teeth or whatever, those could be subtle signs or not so subtle of having a liver problem, because the liver is responsible for a lot of stuff that happens in our bodies. And a lot of these kind of issues that may seem low grade could be, you know, a harbinger of something going on with the liver.
Is it possible, and this may be very naive, but to, if you had a slight elevation in your liver, for whatever it may be, to repair it yourself, whether it be nutritionally or dietary? I mean, I've read things in the online about milk thistle. I mean, some patients are using that. Is there any truth to any of that?
Well, you have to be careful with kind of medicines that people that you kind of hear about, or you know, over the counter stuff, or herbs, or you know, things like that, because those things actually can cause liver failure. They can be toxic to the liver if they're either not the right ones are taken, or if they're taken in excess. The liver, yes, it can repair itself. But what I would say is, when you have an elevation in your liver tests, that needs to be looked at, because usually there's something going on.
Yes.
And so you kind of want to figure out what the underlying problem is, and not just think it's going to be some, you know, short-term thing that's just going to go away. Could be, but also you kind of want to get that worked up, and you want to go to your doc and you know, have your enzymes rechecked, your liver tests rechecked, and also some other blood tests probably that they'll order.
Well, Dr. Dagger, I want to thank you again. If you're listening out there, and for our listeners, is there a website or a phone number that people can contact you if they have questions about this or need to be evaluated?
You know, great question. Yes, absolutely. I've got, look here, they can call the NYU Transplant Institute.
Okay.
And that's, you know, they can certainly... you know, that's easily found online. It's you know, it's everywhere online, no matter what the organ is. And there's a great mainframe that will patch you into, you know, whatever organ you want to have you have questions about. And we're here for you.
Okay. Thank you so much again, Dr. Nabil Dagger, the director of the Transabdominal Transplant Center, the Abdominal Transplant Center at NYU Langone Center in Manhattan. Thank you so much. An outstanding show, and really educated me and many of our listeners this morning. Thank you so much, sir. Have a wonderful day. That's the end of the show, everyone. Have a wonderful Sunday. Tune in every Sunday here on Katz's Corner. This is Dr. Aaron Katz.
WABC, New York.